May it please the court, Donald Corbett with the law firm of Lowenstein Sandler for plaintiff appellant Sheldon Solo. This case involves a claim by Mr. Solo, a limited partner in a Delaware limited partnership, as well as related entities to the general partner. And the partnership involved the development of 3D technology to explore and exploit natural gas and oil resources. This case provides an opportunity for this court to reaffirm the court's strong and Delaware's strong public policy in favor of decision on the merits. That's particularly in cases that involve Delaware and business entities, particularly in cases where there's allegations of self-dealing and wrongdoing by the general partner of a Delaware business entity, and particularly where those claims have either been sustained by the court below or have gone unchallenged by the defendant.
Can we just more or less cut to the chase?
Certainly.
There was a two-year period of time where, at least according to the docket sheet, there was absolutely no activity, correct?
According to the docket sheet, correct.
All right. And I understand that there was some back and forth about whether the address was correct and so on, but eventually the trial court allowed your client to come in and show good reason for not dismissing this case. And if I understand correctly, your client said, well, there were some settlement discussions at some point, and that's it. Is that supposed to account for 2 years of inactivity?
Well, I think that that there were, in fact, substantive settlement negotiations going on for an extended period of time, including up to approximately 2 or 3 months before Justice Chandler wrote his January 2011 letter to purportedly to the parties, or intended to go to the parties. So,
what evidence was there before the trial court that for a period of a year and a half or more there were active settlement discussions?
Well, we certainly presented that information to the court below in our motion practice.
What in particular was happening? Were there communications? Could you produce letters back and forth or something to show that there really was something going on?
Yes, we actually made a motion to the court to expand the record to submit the actual emails that went back and forth between the parties, and I do have those. The motion was denied, but I do have those here today if the court would like to look at those. And I don't think it's unusual that the parties are engaged in, and particularly in a commercial matter where it is a monetary dispute, where parties are, if they are engaged in substantive settlement negotiations, that the prosecution, otherwise the prosecution of the claim, may go into hiatus for a period while they pursue those settlement discussions. And these settlement discussions were, I know there's some dispute as to the substantive nature, whether they're substantive or not. I think defense counsel acknowledges there were discussions. They dispute whether they were substantive or not, but certainly they were substantive to the extent that they resulted in a mid-seven-figure offer.
This is an abuse of discretion claim, correct?
Correct, Your Honor.
If we were to agree with you that there was an abuse of discretion, how would you, how would we craft an opinion that states in a sentence, or not much more, the reason why it was an abuse of discretion?
Well, I think
what's the rule of law, so to speak?
Sure. I think you can look to two things for guidance there. One is how courts have previously treated motions to dismiss based on failure to prosecute. And secondly, this court, in an en banc decision in Ditchman, articulated six factors that the court should consider when determining whether the dismissal was an abuse of discretion. I think if evaluating those factors in the context of this case.
Well, I'm asking you to give us verbatim, what the opinion would say, not two paragraphs that you just did.
Certainly. I'm happy to run through the factors if you'd like.
No, if we were to agree with you, we would have to hold that, in dismissing this case for failure to prosecute, the Chancellor abused his discretion because.
Because, one, fundamentally, there was a lack of notice to the parties. Mr. Solo did not receive notice of Justice Chandler or Chancellor Chandler's January 11th, 2011 order, or, I'm sorry, letter asking for what's going on in the case.
Right, but eventually he did find out what was going on and was given an opportunity to do what he would have had to do had he gotten notice. So that, cured that problem. What else?
Well, but I don't think, with all due respect, I don't think it really did cure that problem, because he was, I think Mr. Solo was unfairly prejudiced by not getting that letter, because Justice Chandler, in his letter, if you look at the letter closely, and I can direct you to it in the record, it says essentially, what's going on with the case? Are you prosecuting it? If you are, send me a status order, a scheduling order, and proceed from there. And that was it. And that was in the context, and if you look at Justice Chandler's decisions, and we cite a number of those decisions in our reply brief at page 9.
You're losing me. If I had to write an opinion, you know, that recited verbatim what you just told me, we'd never get to the end. What is the rule of law, you know, that would explain to the litigants and the public why there was an abuse of discretion?
Well, because here Mr. Solo did not get notice of...
Well, technically, what we're being asked to review is the denial of relief under Rule 60B. Isn't that true?
That is true.
And for that, there was notice and an opportunity to be heard.
Absolutely.
And that also involves an abuse of discretion standard of review, right?
Correct.
So, if to rephrase the question in terms of filling in the blank, the Chancellor abused his discretion in not granting relief under Rule 60B because?
Because I think that that decision ultimately incorporated all the substance of the original letter to, in other words, if the two analyses are under 41E, is there a, was there a failure to prosecute? And then there's 60B, is there, you know, is this a subsequent decision, a subsequent rule? Everything that's incorporated in that second decision by Chancellor Strine, in effect, incorporates what was reflected in the earlier request from the court. In other words, the Justice Chancellor Strine.
The notice is gone, isn't it? Because you did have notice, at least an opportunity to be heard.
Right, but the distinction, I think, that and it's a very important distinction, is that there was an additional hurdle that Mr. Solo had to satisfy with Chancellor Strine's letter back in July. In other words, in the first letter from Chancellor Chandler, he merely asked, you know, what's going on, and if you're prosecuting, please send me a scheduling order, words to that effect. And if Mr. Solo had gotten that letter, that's what he would have done. He would have sent in the scheduling order, he would have conferred with counsel, and submitted an order. But when Chancellor Strine later on offered this opportunity to be heard in July, he set the bar higher and required Mr. Solo to show more than Chancellor Chandler required or asked for of Mr. Solo initially. And I think
why is that an abuse of discretion?
Well, because it's a harsh penalty to employ against a party who didn't receive. In other words, you're putting my client in two separate. It's going to be evaluated under two different separate standards. Under Chancellor Chandler, he would have been evaluated under this much lower standard. In other words, Justice Chandler would require much less for Mr. Solo than Chancellor Strine ultimately required of
And
of
what difference
Mr. Solo.
Does that make? Chancellor Strine was the judge at the point at which the events took place, not Chancellor Chandler.
Well, I think that the other issues with all due respect to Chancellor Strine was that it was a rush decision. In other words, he didn't get Mr. Solo wasn't afforded the typical opportunity to respond that litigants usually get in the Chancery Court.
What do you mean he didn't get an opportunity to respond?
Well, he didn't get an opportunity to reply. In other words, there was a Chancellor Strine asked for a submission as to, essentially a motion as to why why the case shouldn't be dismissed. There was one submission. Typically, in motion practice in Chancery Court, there's the moving papers, opposition, and reply. we were not afforded an opportunity to reply. Secondly, we were not given an opportunity to for oral argument. Typically, in Chancery Court, there's at least a telephone conference so that the parties can articulate their positions.
You aren't really asking us to issue an opinion saying it's an abuse of discretion for the trial court to conduct motion practice the way this trial court did?
I think it's if you layer all these issues together, if you start with the fact that, you know, coupled against the extreme sanction that was provided here, with these other, I'd say, lack of opportunities or diminished opportunities, that could Mr. Solo have prosecuted the case more diligently? Absolutely. Was the appropriate sanction under these circumstances dismissal? I would say absolutely not.
So where does the line get drawn when we're talking in multiples of years? We've got 2 years here. Is 3 years enough?
Well, I think it's if a party is told, look, you do X or Y, and you don't, and if you don't do it, the case is going to get dismissed. That would be an appropriate place to draw the line. But to, you know, I think arbitrarily draw, you haven't, you know, done anything for 2 years, we're going to send notice, but you won't get it. I think that under these circumstances, it is an abuse of discretion.
So if, even though the rule talks about 30 days, doesn't it, in terms of failure to prosecute?
If you don't provide a response, I believe, within the 30 days.
But in any event, you're saying that it's acceptable litigation practice for the plaintiff to do nothing in court for 2 years and then be given an opportunity to cure that, as opposed to being given an opportunity to explain satisfactorily what was going on during those 2 years.
Well, I think based on the prior jurisprudence of this court and the Chancery Court, that if there was a substantive settlement negotiations during that 2 year period, particularly if those discussions were as recently as 2 or 3 months before the actual notice that was sent out by Justice Chandler that my client didn't get, I would say that then that is sufficient activity to or cause or good reason not to dismiss the case or fail to prosecute.
So if we boil this down, the basis for reversing and finding an abuse of discretion is that there was activity at some point during that 2 years, and that was substantive settlement negotiations at unspecified times.
Well, I can give you the specific times. I mean, this wasn't a case where the case was totally abandoned by Mr. Soule. This was in a case where I think falls even in the definition of failure to prosecute. This was a case where for a period of time, I believe it was from, just looking at my notes, bear with me 1 second, there was active settlement negotiations. I'm just looking for the exact days, if you bear with me. I believe it was from the spring, March of 2010 to October or November of 2010.
Let me just see if I have this right. You're arguing that it was an abuse of discretion to dismiss the case, and the first reason is lack of notice, and you're claiming that the lack of notice was prejudicial even though Mr. Solow was given the opportunity later to state his position to the court, because had notice been given in a timely way, his only obligation would have been to report what was going on, whereas by the time he actually got notice and had to respond, he was under a burden to show why judgment against him should not be vacated. Is that a fair statement?
The only thing I would add on to that is that that there was not a period of 2 year inactivity that in the
well, that's a different issue. I'm just asking what I'm asking you is whether your contention is that the prejudice from the lack of notice was that he was, you know, he ended up with a higher procedural burden than he would have had he not gotten late notice.
I believe that's absolutely part of it. I don't think that that's the sum and substance
okay.
of it, though.
Well, then my next question is, what else, independent of that, constitutes an abuse of discretion, if anything?
That there were alternative sanctions available to the court that the court didn't explore, that this is a, particularly when viewed in the context of a case that has undeniably had merit, in that claims were sustained on a motion to dismiss and a motion for summary judgment, and other claims went unchallenged, and that there was not a history of dilatory conduct here. There was not a history of where an abuse of court orders. This wasn't a case where there were prior orders that the plaintiff disregarded.
You're using your rebuttal time, which you're welcome to. But
well, I'll sit down now, unless the court has any questions at this point.
Good afternoon, members of the Honorable Court. John Abramczyk, appearing on behalf of Appellees. May it please the court. If I could use just the few minutes we have this afternoon to talk about three things. One, just to briefly review the standard. Two, to talk about why the appellant doesn't meet those standards. And three, to specifically address some of the questions that came up, and why the record that was presented to the Chancellor shows that the case is so much more egregious than Appellee would let on by the rather sterile explanations of what was going on in this case. First, on the standards. As the court has already alluded to, the appellee comes in here today with a very heavy burden. He comes today asking you to reverse the Court of Chancery's order that refused to reopen a judgment under Rule 60B. A motion that is addressed, as this court has recognized, to the sound discretion of the trial court, which, as this court well knows, requires only that the lower court's decision be supported by the record and reflect a logical and orderly deductive reasoning process under the Leavitt versus Bouvier standard. So accordingly, the ruling from the Court of Chancery could only be set aside today if there were some abuse of discretion identified. And quite plainly, the silence has been deafening on that, any such abuse of discretion. But
well,
in addition,
I think there was a fairly consistent suggestion by opposing counsel that there was a period of 6 months during which there were substantive settlement negotiations, and that negotiations of that sort typically take place while there is no activity on the court's docket, but when explained to the court, frequently are sufficient to avoid dismissal for failure to prosecute.
Yes, Your Honor, that's the offered explanation, but it doesn't rise to the level of showing an abuse of discretion by the trial court here, because the facts, whatever Appellee, then the plaintiff, said they were on those settlement discussions, were presented to the Chancellor. The Chancellor acknowledges this in his opinion. He says specifically, I know in making my decision to refuse to reopen this dismissal, I know that there was mention of the settlement discussions, he says, in substance, really didn't amount to much, and it's certainly not enough to give good reason to excuse your failure to continue to prosecute your case. So, whatever happens
what
with
signal,
the...
What signal, if any, was ever given by the court for Chancellor Chandler's letter? There was no scheduling order in this case. There used to be called the calendars periodically in the Court of Chancery. Apparently none was done for this case. There's no communication from the court, no communication, no application by the defendants to move to dismiss for failure to prosecute. Why is it unfair to say that the plaintiff was lulled into this delay is okay?
Well, this is absolutely not a plaintiff who was lulled into thinking the delay was okay. Remember that the record here shows, and it was the record before the chancellor, that this was a sophisticated litigant that had multiple rounds of New York counsel at the very top firms, as well as one of the top firms in Delaware representing him through the long course of this litigation. And perhaps most tellingly, if you look at the appendix, B-17 is where this appears, and you look at Richard Layton's motion to withdraw and the reasons why, and remember, they were the last out the door here, the reasons why the Richard Layton firm withdrew from this representation was because after the New York firms had decided that they would withdraw from the case, and this is back in 2007 and 2008, Richard Layton goes to Mr. Solo and says, we need to work out some arrangement. And he says nothing. He won't communicate with them. They forward materials from the case to him, and he says nothing. The silence is deafening. And this is in paragraph 5 of Mr. Rollo's affidavit. I think it's B-17 of the appendix. And Richard Layton says, we are going to get out of this case if you don't communicate with us about your case. And there is nothing from Mr. Solo, and they move to withdraw, and they do withdraw. And then what happens next? Well, Mr. Solo then gets his own general counsel. He first, this is in March of 2009, Mr. Rollo withdraws.
What does that mean, general counsel? His personal attorney? Or?
His firm's general counsel. He only identifies himself, Mr. Hayes identifies himself as in his affidavit as the general counsel for Solo Realty Corporation in New York.
Which is not a party to this action.
Correct. Not a party to this action. It's Mr. Solo personally. But importantly, if you look at the affidavit, that was submitted by Mr. Hayes, which is in the appendix at A220 to 221, Mr. Hayes describes himself as the general counsel to Solo Realty Development Company and Sheldon Solo since July of 2009. And so in July of 2009, July 7th to be specific, Mr. Rollo withdraws. Within about a week, and although the record is fuzzy on this, Mr. Hayes is not precise about this in his affidavit, he says shortly after Richard Layton gets out of the case, he comes on board as Mr. Solo's general counsel. So, I skipped one step. First, after Richard Layton gets out, Mr. Solo files a letter with the Register and Chancery saying, I'm going to be pro se, here's my address. Then Mr. Hayes comes on board as a general counsel and doesn't do anything to correct the record to let the court know or let the LexisNexis filing system know that he's now on board as general counsel for Mr. Solo. And then he says he proceeds to try to find counsel and apparently never does until after this dismissal. Well, importantly, and one of the pieces that was left out of the explanation here by the appellant is during that entire period of time, of course, the rule in this court is well established that whether you're a pro se litigant or not, you have a duty to monitor the docket. So to get to Your Honor's question, when it talks about, well, did he really have anything said from the Court of Chancery to him about there was some impending dismissal, the answer is there is nothing on the docket until the Chancellor's letter of January of 2011, nor is there required to be, nor is there any requirement that defendants keep plaintiff informed of the progress of the case in one way or the other. And perhaps most compellingly here, this is not a widow or orphan a la the Nanticoke case where you have some person who's not familiar with the justice system and how courts work that's trying to figure out what's going on and hasn't had a fair opportunity. This is somebody who was lawyered up in the extreme at the beginning and continued to have well-qualified counsel well through, including his own personal general counsel at the time he's purporting to be before this court pro se. So there is no requirement under the rules or otherwise that there be the annual notification to parties that you better get moving or your case could be dismissed. The pro se litigant is, especially in this case, in a circumstance in where he had unequivocally, the Giordano case speaks to this, and we cite all these cases in our brief, unequivocally his own obligation to keep on top of that docket, and I would submit the obligation to know what the rules are, at least in terms of knowing precisely what the obligations might be when there had been no activity in the case. And remember, we're saying 2 years, but it's more than 2 years. If you look back, it goes back almost 3 years here. So when the court asks the question, how many years is too many? This is pretty close to three. It's closer to three than two.
Okay, but I'm still not hearing any discussion about the settlement negotiations.
Your Honor, the settlement negotiations did occur, as the appellant's counsel has said, the last communication was into the fall of 2010. There was nothing that was in any way resolved, and importantly, this was this was Aspect Resources going to the plaintiff and inquiring, what are you going to do? And we point this out in the brief, Mr. Solo comes back and said, I'm either going to settle or I'm going to litigate. That's how it ended in October of 2010. And that was it. The ball was firmly in Mr. Solo's court. And what do we get back? The record here is that Mr. Solo's general counsel comes in and says, well, yes, I told them that, and wants to make much of these settlement discussions. And yet, it was completely within their control to do whatever they were going to do about it. The last message back to Aspect was, I'm going to litigate or settle. Nothing comes back. And then we hear from Mr. Hayes in his affidavit, I think this is page A221 of the appendix. He says, well, I was waiting until I got counsel on board, and then he gives it up. He says, at the turn of the year of 2011, I knew we didn't have counsel. I thought I had somebody lined up. Didn't work out. At the turn of the calendar in 2011, right at the same time or just before, it's not perfectly clear on the record, Chancellor Chandler issued his warning letter. Mr. Solo's general counsel has testified before the Court of Chancery, and it's in the record here, that he knew he didn't have counsel. And he did nothing. He did nothing to continue the settlement discussions. So that doesn't rise, the court below appropriately found, that whatever those settlement discussions were on that record, they don't rise to the level of giving good reason to undo a dismissal under 41E for lack of prosecution. Yes,
Let me go back to an argument that was made earlier, and that is that there was a lack of proper notice to Mr. Solo of his obligation to respond to the yearly status reports. And as a consequence, Mr. Solo was prejudiced because by the time he did get notice and had to respond, he was now under a burden to show the court why the judgment shouldn't be vacated. So he was in a worse off procedural posture. What's your response to that argument?
That's absolutely correct. He's in a more rigorous level of proof. And as I started into the standards, I didn't get to the important second point. Yes, you start here today with plaintiff having to get over the hurdle on an abuse of discretion standard, but importantly, the court doesn't end its inquiry on a 60B6 dismissal there. It goes on, and in the 60B6 context, as the court has recognized in the Hoffman opinion, the court superimposes upon the abuse of discretion standard a higher standard, which says, once an order has been entered dismissing a case, the movement coming forward to the court to try to undo that dismissal must raise extraordinary circumstances.
Well,
should be done.
You agree then with the plaintiff's contention that he was prejudiced, procedurally prejudiced, by not getting notice the first time around of his obligation to report to the court?
Respectfully, Your Honor, no. Even though the standard shifted, he hasn't been unfairly prejudiced, and I'll tell you why. Because if you look at Chancellor Strine's opinion, Chancellor Strine treats this under the Rule 41 standard and doesn't hold Mr. Solo to the higher 60B6 standard. He goes through that analysis and says, I hear what Mr. Solo is saying. I hear what he's saying about not having notice of this and worried about whether, and rather than resolving a debate over whether it was more Mr. Solo's fault, as in Giordano, where somebody's not monitoring the docket, and Vice Chancellor Lamb says, look, you have a duty to monitor the docket, and if you don't, there are consequences. But rather than unpack all that, the current chancellor says, look, I'm going to give you a chance, Mr. Solo, to come forward, just as if you were in the Rule 41 posture, and tell me the good reasons. Tell me the good reasons why you shouldn't be dismissed. And what does he come back with? He comes back with the same arguments that the court has heard this morning, this afternoon, which is, well, you know, I didn't really give notice. And as the court has appropriately pointed out, that's not really the case because he was given the second bite at the apple already. Then they talk about the settlement discussions, and we've already been through why that doesn't rise to the level of good cause. And then they talk about the general policy against defaults. And then what we heard today is sort of an amped up version of, well, there could have been other sanctions. Well, no. There aren't other sanctions under Rule 41E. When you're under Rule 41E, 41E says that the Court of Chancery may dismiss your case for lack of activity for 1 year. This is nearly 3 years. It's a facts and circumstances inquiry. It's made doubly difficult here by the 60B6 posture, but even if you dial it back to the Rule 41 posture, there still is no evidence, not a whisper of an abuse of discretion as it applies.
About, the evidence or information before the chancellor. One of his concluding lines is, over 2 years of doing nothing is inexcusable and prejudicial. So he listened to the excuses and decided not to find justification for it. But he also says it was prejudicial. And what was the basis for that?
He makes that determination, Your Honor, on the longstanding rule that's been applied many, many times by courts, including this court, that says that it is fundamentally unfair to litigants to have unreasonable delay as time and primarily because as time passes, the ability to find the truth in the case becomes more and more difficult. Remember, this is a case where we're talking about events that happened in the 1990s. We're talking about a case that started in 2004, 8 plus 9 years ago.
So it was prejudicial to the other litigants? Is that the answer?
Correct, Your Honor. It would be prejudicial to reopen this because this plaintiff has been so dilatory. And we cite the burn-up cases and the I believe it's the Wright and Miller treatise in our brief on this point, and that is that the prejudice against the defendant below here, the appellee today, is manifest and self-evident on the face of this record because of those concerns that underlie these very rules, which is why the court's allowed to do what it does.
Notice of the length of time as shown by the docket establishes prejudice per se.
Yes, Your Honor.
I'd like to get back to the settlement discussions and what arguably is the practice in the Court of Chancery. This is not the only case where a plaintiff has not been submitting anything, filing any documents, taking any discovery, whatever, for what appears to be an extended period of time. And yet, my understanding is that frequently when that apparent lack of activity is of concern to the court, the plaintiff says, well, actually, we've been in settlement discussions, but they're not getting anywhere or whatever, and now we're going to move forward. And as a general rule, that's an acceptable excuse, if you will, for the lack of docket activity. Why is that not acceptable here?
Because, Your Honor, it's not always acceptable, and we cite the CENTCOM cases in our opinion. Wood and CENTCOM are two sort of companion cases on that, where Vice Chancellor Noble and others have recognized that settlement discussions might rise to the level of good calls for failing to prosecute that might be reflected on the docket. Very importantly, here they do not, for the reasons we talked about before. And perhaps most to the point, and Justice Ridgely, I think, obliquely just touched on this, whatever those discussions were presented to the Chancellor. He considered them in making his decision as to whether the case, the order should remain in place, dismissing the case. And he, on his facts and circumstances inquiry at the trial court, looked at this and applied a logical and deductive reasoning process and said they don't rise to the level that would give good cause to excuse somebody for more than 2 years of not prosecuting their case. So that's why the settlement discussions don't help them here. In addition, keep in mind, Solo never, ever responded to whatever was on the table. Thank the court. I appreciate the time today.
Thank you, Your Honors. I think one point is worth particularly noting on the issue which Your Honors characterized as potential procedural prejudice, is that when the January 11, 2011 letter came out from Chancellor Chandler, it was addressed to plaintiff's former counsel, but according to the record, which we demonstrate in our papers, it didn't get there. And it was also addressed to third-party or non-party counsel, someone that was involved in a discovery dispute, and they did receive it. And it was not addressed to defense counsel, but the record's clear that that letter was actually received by, or it was delivered in the LexisNexis system to defense counsel. And defense counsel didn't do anything with that letter. This was a directive from the court to act, report what's going on, and counsel did not contact the court.
You're talking about the letter, the first letter?
Correct.
The one that you say was never received by Mr. Solo.
Correct.
Okay. I think everybody concedes that he didn't get the letter.
No, but my point is that this letter was received by defense counsel.
And so what?
Well, my understanding, the customer practice in Chancery Court is that usually when counsel receives a letter from the court, either they respond to the court or they contact opposing counsel to discuss how are we going to respond to this letter.
This goes to the argument that defense counsel should have contacted Mr. Solo.
Correct.
Mr. Solo cannot be faulted for failing to monitor the docket himself.
Well, I think that the idea of monitoring the docket is being elevated to a level that I don't believe it exists.
You don't think there's a duty?
No, I'm not saying that. I don't think it rises to the level and supplants and rises above the right for litigants to have their disputes heard before the court, particularly in the circumstances that are presented before the court today.
Okay, well, that I can understand conceptually, that argument. But the argument you were making a moment ago, the only conclusion I draw from it is that you're trying to negate the duty to monitor itself by putting all the onus on defense counsel.
I don't mean to convey that at all. I think that, again, I said at the outset, and I'll say it again, I think that certainly Mr. Solo could have prosecuted this case more diligently, more vigorously. But I don't think that the appropriate sanction in these circumstances is dismissal of a claim, particularly when those claims have been sustained on a motions to dismiss and motions for summary judgment, and when there's a mid-seven-figure settlement offer that's only been out there for 2 or 3 months. And as far as the ability for the court to impose other lesser sanctions, I think that there are plenty of options out there for the court. One would be to impose a scheduling order that has a zero tolerance basis. In other words, this is the scheduling order. This is what the parties are going to abide by.
Options, but you're forgetting the procedural context. Now, this is not a case like Drechko where there was failure to follow discovery deadlines, to meet discovery deadlines and to obey court orders. This is a Rule 41 proceeding where the option is basically to either allow the case to go forward or to dismiss it for failure to prosecute, for inactivity. Those are the options.
Certainly, but I think that it's clear from how from Chancellor Chandler handled these cases. If you look at his decisions, it's clear that what he was asking for was a scheduling order, and if he received that, this case would not have been dismissed. He was not seeking or not soliciting the type of demonstrated what essentially what Chancellor Strachan was seeking for when he issued his letter.
Thank you. Your time is up.
Thank you. Thank you, Your Honors.
We appreciate the arguments, and we will adjourn.